were moving about, or sitting on benches under the shed. They were all cleanly dressed, the men with hats, the women with handkerchiefs tied about their heads. Birch and Gooden, after separating from us, walked up the steps at the back part of the main building and sat down upon the door sill. They entered into conversation, but the subject of it I could not hear. Presently Birch came down into the yard, unfettered me, and led me into one of the small houses. "You told that man you came from New York," said he. I replied, "I told him I had been up as far as New York, to be sure, but did not tell him I belonged there, nor that I was a free man. I meant no harm at all, Master Birch. I would not have said it had I thought." He looked at me a moment as if he were ready to devour me, then turning round went out. In a few minutes he returned. "If ever I hear you say a word about New York or about your freedom, I will be the death of you. I will kill you. You may rely on that," he ejaculated fiercely. I doubt not he understood then, better than I did, the danger and the penalty of selling a free man into slavery. He felt the necessity of closing my mouth against the crime he knew he was committing. Of course, my life would not have weighed a feather in any emergency requiring such a sacrifice. Undoubtedly, he meant precisely what he said. Under the shed, on one side of the yard, there was constructed a rough table, while overhead were sleeping lofts, the same as in the pen at Washington. After partaking at this table of our supper of pork and bread, I was handcuffed to a large yellow man, quite stout and fleshy, with a countenance expressive of the utmost melancholy. He was a man of intelligence and information. Chained together, it was not long before we became acquainted with each other's history. His name was Robert. Like myself, he had been born free and had a wife and two children in Cincinnati. He said he had come south with two men who had hired him in the city of his residence. Without free papers, he had been seized at Fredericksburg, placed in confinement, and beaten until he had learned, as I had, the necessity and the policy of silence. He had been in Gooden's pen about 3 weeks. To this man I became much attached. We could sympathize with and understand each other. It was with tears and a heavy heart, not many days subsequently, that I saw him die and looked for the last time upon his lifeless form. Robert and myself, with Clem, Eliza, and her children, slept that night upon our blankets in one of the small houses in the yard. There were four others, all from the same plantation, who had been sold and were now on their way south, who also occupied it with us. David and his wife, Caroline, both mulattoes, were exceedingly affected. They dreaded the thought of being put into the cane and cotton fields, but their greatest source of anxiety was the apprehension of being separated. Mary, a tall, lithe girl of a most jetty black, was listless and apparently indifferent. Like many of the class, she scarcely knew there was such a word as freedom. Brought up in the ignorance of a brute, she possessed but little more than a brute's intelligence. She was one of those, and there are very many, who fear nothing but their master's lash, and know no further duty than to obey his voice. The other was Lethe. She was an entirely different character. She had long, straight hair, and wore more the appearance of an Indian than a woman. She had sharp and spiteful eyes, and continually gave utterance to the language of hatred and revenge. Her husband had been sold. She knew not where she was. An exchange of masters, she was sure, could not be for the worse. She cared not whither they might carry her. Pointing to the scars upon her face, the desperate creature wished that she might see the day when she could wipe them off in some man's blood. While we were thus learning the history of each other's wretchedness, Eliza was seated in a corner by herself, singing hymns and praying for her children. Wearied from the loss of so much sleep, I could no longer bear up against the advances of that sweet restorer, and laying down by the side of Robert on the floor, soon forgot my troubles and slept until the dawn of day. In the morning, having swept the yard and washed ourselves under Gooden's superintendence, we were ordered to roll up our blankets and make ready for the continuance of our journey. Clem Ray was informed that he would go no further, Birch for some cause having concluded to carry him back to Washington. He was much rejoiced. Shaking hands, we parted in the slave pen at Richmond, and I have not seen him since. But much to my surprise, since my return, I learned that he had escaped from bondage and on his way to the free soil of Canada, lodged one night at the house of my brother-in-law in Saratoga, informing my family of the place and the condition in which he left me. In the afternoon, we were drawn up, two abreast, Robert and myself in advance, and in this order, driven by Birch and Gooden from the yard, through the streets of Richmond to the brig Orleans. She was a vessel of respectable size, full-rigged and freighted principally with tobacco. We were all on board by 5 o'clock. Birch brought us each a tin cup and a spoon. There were 40 of us in the brig, being all except Clem that were in the pen. With a small pocket knife that had not been taken from me, I began cutting the initials of my name upon the tin cup. The others immediately flocked round me, requesting me to mark theirs in a similar manner. In time, I gratified them all, of which they did not appear to be forgetful. We were all stowed away in the hold at night, and the hatch barred down. We laid on boxes or wherever there was room enough to stretch our blankets on the floor. Birch accompanied us no further than Richmond, returning from that point to the capital with Clem. Not until the lapse of almost 12 years, to wit, in January last in the Washington police office, did I set my eyes upon his face again. James H. Birch was a slave trader, buying men, women, and children at low prices, and selling them at an advance. He was a speculator in human flesh, a disreputable calling, and so considered at the South. For the present, he disappears from the scenes recorded in this narrative. But he will appear again before its close, not in the character of a man-whipping tyrant, but as an arrested, cringing criminal in a court of law that failed to do him justice. Chapter 5. After we were all on board, the brig Orleans proceeded down James River. Passing into Chesapeake Bay, we arrived next day opposite the city of Norfolk. While lying at anchor, a lighter approached us from the town, bringing 4 more slaves. Frederick, a boy of 18, had been born a slave, as also had Henry, who was some years older. They had both been house servants in the city. Maria was a rather gentle-looking colored girl, with a faultless form, but ignorant and extremely vain. The idea of going to New Orleans was pleasing to her. She entertained an extravagantly high opinion of her own attractions. Assuming a haughty mien, she declared to her companions that immediately on her arrival in New Orleans she had no doubt some wealthy single gentleman of good taste would purchase her at once. But the most prominent of the 4 was a man named Arthur. As the lighter approached, he struggled stoutly with his keepers. It was with main force that he was dragged aboard the brig. He protested in a loud voice against the treatment he was receiving, and demanded to be released. His face was swollen and covered with wounds and bruises, and indeed, one side of it was a complete raw sore. He was forced with all haste down the hatchway into the hold. I caught an outline of his story as he was borne struggling along, of which he afterwards gave me a more full relation, and it was as follows. He had long resided in the city of Norfolk, and was a free man. He had a family living there, and was a mason by trade. Having been unusually detained, he was returning late one night to his house in the suburbs of the city, when he was attacked by a gang of persons in an unfrequented street. He fought until his strength failed him. Overpowered at last, he was gagged and bound with ropes and beaten until he became insensible. For several days, they secreted him in the slave pen at Norfolk, a very common establishment, it appears, in the cities of the South. The night before he had been taken out and put on board the lighter, which, pushing out from shore, had awaited our arrival. For some time, he continued his protestations, and was altogether irreconcilable. At length, however, he became silent. He sank into a gloomy and thoughtful mood, and appeared to be counseling with himself. There was, in the man's determined face, something that suggested the thought of desperation. After leaving Norfolk, the handcuffs were taken off, and during the day we were allowed to remain on deck. The captain selected Robert as his waiter, and I was appointed to superintend the cooking department and the distribution of food and water. I had three assistants, Jim, Cuffy, and Jenny. Jenny's business was to prepare the coffee, which consisted of cornmeal, scorched in the kettle, boiled and sweetened with molasses. Jim and Cuffy baked the hoe cake and boiled the bacon. Standing by a table formed of a wide board resting on the heads of the barrels, I cut and handed to each a slice of meat and a darter of the bread, and from Jenny's kettle also dipped out for each a cup of the coffee. The use of plates was dispensed with, and their sable fingers took the place of knives and forks. Jim and Cuffy were very demure and attentive to business, somewhat inflated with their situations as second cooks, and without doubt feeling that there was a great responsibility resting on them. I was called steward, a name given me by the captain. The slaves were fed twice a day, at 10 and 5 o'clock, always receiving the same kind and quantity of fare and in the same manner as above described. At night we were driven into the hold and securely fastened down. Scarcely were we out of sight of land before we were overtaken by a violent storm. The brig rolled and plunged until we feared she would go down. Some were seasick, others on their knees praying, while some were fast holding to each other, paralyzed with fear. The seasickness rendered the place of our confinement loathsome and disgusting. It would have been a happy thing for most of us. It would have saved the agony of many hundred lashes and miserable deaths at last, had the compassionate sea snatched us that day from the clutches of remorseless men. The thought of Randall and little Emmy sinking down among the monsters of the deep is a more pleasant contemplation than to think of them as they are now, perhaps dragging out lives of unrequited toil. When in sight of the Bahama Banks at a place called Old Point Compass, or the Hole in the Wall, we were becalmed 3 days. There was scarcely a breath of air. The waters of the Gulf presented a singularly white appearance, like lime water. In the order of events, I come now to the relation of an occurrence which I never called to mind but with sensations of regret. I thank God, who has since permitted me to escape from the thraldom of slavery, that through his merciful interposition I was prevented from imbruing my hands in the blood of his creatures. Let not those who have never been placed in like circumstances judge me harshly. Until they have been chained and beaten, until they find themselves in the situation I was, borne away from home and family towards a land of bondage, let them refrain from saying what they would not do for liberty. How far I should have been justified in the sight of God and man, it is unnecessary now to speculate upon. It is enough to say that I am able to congratulate myself upon the harmless termination of an affair which threatened, for a time, to be attended with serious results. Towards evening, on the first day of the calm, Arthur and myself were in the bow of the vessel. Seated on the windlass, we were conversing together of the probable destiny that awaited us, and mourning together over our misfortunes. Arthur said, and I agreed with him, that death was far less terrible than the living prospect that was before us. For a long time we talked of our children and our past lives, and of the probabilities of escape. Obtaining possession of the brig was suggested by one of us. We discussed the possibility of our being able, in such an event, to make our way to the harbor of New York. I knew little of the compass, but the idea of risking the experiment was eagerly entertained. The chances for and against us in an encounter with the crew was canvassed. Who could be relied upon and who could not? The proper time and manner of the attack were all talked over and over again. From the moment the plot suggested itself, I began to hope. I revolved it constantly in my mind. As difficulty after difficulty arose, some ready conceit was at hand, demonstrating how it could be overcome. While others slept, Arthur and I were maturing our plans. At length, with much caution, Robert was gradually made acquainted with our intentions. He approved of them at once and entered into the conspiracy with a zealous spirit. It was not another slave we dared to trust. Brought up in fear and ignorance as they are, it can scarcely be conceived how servilely they will cringe before a white man's look. It was not safe to deposit so bold a secret with any of them, and finally we three resolved to take upon ourselves alone the fearful responsibility of the attempt. At night, as has been said, we were driven into the hold and the hatch barred down. How to reach the deck was the first difficulty that presented itself. On the bow of the brig, however, I had observed the small boat lying bottom upwards. It occurred to me that by secreting ourselves underneath it, we would not be missed from the crowd as they were hurried down into the hold at night. I was selected to make the experiment in order to satisfy ourselves of its feasibility. The next evening, accordingly, after supper, watching my opportunity, I hastily concealed myself beneath it. Lying close upon the deck, I could see what was going on around me, while wholly unperceived myself. In the morning, as they came up, I slipped from my hiding place without being observed. The result was entirely satisfactory. The captain and mate slept in the cabin of the former. From Robert, who had frequent occasion in his capacity of waiter to make observations in that quarter, we ascertained the exact position of the respective berths. He further informed us that there were always two pistols and a cutlass lying on the table. The crew's cook slept in the cook galley on deck, a sort of vehicle on wheels that could be moved about as convenience required, while the sailors, numbering only six, either slept in the forecastle or in hammocks swung among the rigging. Finally, our arrangements were all completed. Arthur and I were to steal silently to the captain's cabin, seize the pistols and cutlass, and as quickly as possible, dispatch him and the mate. Robert, with a club, was to stand by the door leading from the deck down into the cabin, and in case of necessity, beat back the sailors until we could hurry to his assistance. We were to proceed then, as circumstances might require. Should the attack be so sudden and successful as to prevent resistance, the hatch was to remain barred down. Otherwise the slaves were to be called up, and in the crowd and hurry and confusion of the time, we resolved to regain our liberty or lose our lives. I was then to assume the unaccustomed place of pilot, and steering northward, we trusted that some lucky wind might bear us to the soil of freedom. The mate's name was Biddy. The captain's I cannot now recall, though I rarely ever forget a name once heard. The captain was a small, genteel man, erect and prompt, with a proud bearing, and looked the personification of courage. If he is still living and these pages should chance to meet his eye, he will learn a fact connected with the voyage of the brig from Richmond to New Orleans in 1841, not entered on his logbook. We were all prepared, and impatiently waiting an opportunity of putting our designs into execution, when they were frustrated by a sad and unforeseen event. Robert was taken ill. It was soon announced that he had the smallpox. He continued to grow worse, and 4 days previous to our arrival in New Orleans, he died. One of the sailors sewed him in his blanket with a large stone from the ballast at his feet, and then laying him on a hatchway and elevating it with tackles above the railing, the inanimate body of poor Robert was consigned to the white waters of the Gulf. We were all panic-stricken by the appearance of the smallpox. The captain ordered lime to be scattered through the hold, and other prudent precautions to be taken. The death of Robert, however, and the presence of the malady, oppressed me sadly, and I gazed out over the great waste of water with a spirit that was indeed disconsolate. An evening or two after Robert's burial, I was leaning on the hatchway near the forecastle, full of desponding thoughts, when a sailor in a kind voice asked me why I was so downhearted. the tone and manner of the man assured me, and I answered, because I was a free man and had been kidnapped. He remarked that it was enough to make anyone downhearted, and continued to interrogate me until he learned the particulars of my whole history. He was evidently much interested in my behalf, and in the blunt speech of a sailor swore he would aid me all he could, if it split his timbers. I requested him to furnish me pen, ink, and paper, in order that I might write to some of my friends. He promised to obtain them, but how I could use them undiscovered was a difficulty. If I could only get into the forecastle while his watch was off and the other sailors asleep, the thing could be accomplished. The small boat instantly occurred to me. He thought we were not far from the Belize, at the mouth of the Mississippi, and it was necessary that the letter be written soon, for the opportunity would be lost. Accordingly, by arrangement, I managed the next night to secret myself again under the longboat. His watch was off at 12. I saw him pass into the forecastle, and in about an hour followed him. He was nodding over a table, half asleep, on which a sickly light was flickering, and on which also was a pen and a sheet of paper. As I entered, he aroused, beckoned me to sit beside him, and pointed to the paper. I directed the letter to Henry B. Northup, of Sandy Hill, stating that I had been kidnapped, was then on board the brig Orleans bound for New Orleans, that it was then impossible for me to conjecture my ultimate destination, and requesting he would take measures to rescue me. The letter was sealed and directed, and Manning, having read it, promised to deposit in the New Orleans post office. I hastened back to my place under the longboat, and in the morning, as the slaves came up and were walking round, crept out unnoticed and mingled with them. My good friend, whose name was John Manning, was an Englishman by birth, and a noble-hearted, generous sailor as ever walked the deck. He had lived in Boston, was a tall, well-built man, about 24 years old, with a face somewhat pockmarked but full of benevolent expression. Nothing to vary the monotony of our daily life occurred until we reached New Orleans. On coming to the levee and before the vessel was made fast, I saw Manning leap on shore and hurry away into the city. As he started off, he looked back over his shoulder significantly, giving me to understand the object of his errand. Presently he returned, and passing close by me, hunched me with his elbow with a peculiar wink, as much to say, "It is all right." The letter, as I have since learned, reached Sandy Hill. Mr. Northup visited Albany and laid it before Governor Seward, but inasmuch as it gave no definite information as to my probable locality, it was not at that time deemed advisable to institute measures for my liberation. It was concluded to delay, trusting that a knowledge of where I was might eventually be obtained. A happy and touching scene was witnessed immediately upon our reaching the levee. Just as Manning left the brig on the way to the post office, two men came up and called aloud for Arthur. The latter, as he recognized them, was almost crazy with delight. He could hardly be restrained from leaping over the brig's side, and when they met soon after, he grasped them by the hand and clung to them a long, long time. They were men from Norfolk who had come to New Orleans to rescue him. His kidnappers, they informed him, had been arrested and were then confined in a Norfolk prison. They conversed a few moments with the captain, and then departed with the rejoicing Arthur. But in all the crowd that thronged the wharf, there was no one who knew or cared for me. Not one. No familiar voice greeted my ears, nor was there a single face that I had ever seen. Soon Arthur would rejoin his family and have the satisfaction of seeing his wrongs avenged. My family, alas, should I ever see them more? There was a feeling of utter desolation in my heart, filling it with a despairing and regretful sense that I had not gone down with Robert to the bottom of the sea. Very soon traders and consignees came on board. One, a tall, thin-faced man with light complexion and a little bent, made his appearance with a paper in his hand. Birch's gang, consisting of myself, Eliza, and her children, Harry, Lethe, and some others, who had joined us at Richmond, were consigned to him. This gentleman was Theophilus Freeman. Reading from his paper, he called, "Platt." No one answered. The name was called again and again, but still there was no reply. Then Lethe was called, then Eliza, then Harry, until the list was finished, each one stepping forward as his or her name was called. "Captain, where's Platt?" demanded Theophilus Freeman. The captain was unable to inform him, no one being on board answering to that name. "Who shipped that nigger?" he again inquired of the captain, pointing to me. "Birch," replied the captain. "Your name is Platt. You answer my description. Why don't you come forward?" he demanded of me in an angry tone. I informed him that was not my name, that I had never been called by it, but that I had no objection to it as I knew of. "Well, I will learn you your name," said he, "and so you won't forget it either," he added. Mr. Theophilus Freeman, by the way, was not a whit behind his partner Birch in the matter of blasphemy. On the vessel I had gone by the name of Stewart, and this was the first time I had ever been designated as Platt, the name forwarded by Birch to his consignee. From the vessel I observed the chain gang at work on the levee. We passed near them as we were driven to Freeman's slave pen. This pen is very similar to Gooden's in Richmond, except the yard was enclosed by plank standing upright with ends sharpened instead of brick walls. Including us, there were now at least 50 in this pen. Depositing our blankets in one of the small buildings in the yard, and having been called up and fed, we were allowed to saunter about the enclosure until night, when we wrapped our blankets around us and laid down under the shed or in the loft or in the open yard, just as each one preferred. It was but a short time I closed my eyes that night. Thought was busy in my brain. Could it be possible that I was thousands of miles from home, that I had been driven through the streets like a dumb beast, that I had been chained and beaten without any mercy, that I was even herded with a drove of slaves, a slave myself? Were the events of the last few weeks realities indeed? Or was I passing only through the dismal phases of a long, protracted dream? It was no illusion. My cup of sorrow was full to overflowing. Then I lifted up my hands to God, and in the still watches of the night, surrounded by the sleeping forms of my companions, begged for mercy on the poor forsaken captive. To the Almighty Father of us all, the freeman and the slave, I poured forth the supplications of a broken spirit, imploring strength from on high to bear up against the burden of my troubles, until the morning light aroused the slumberers, ushering in another day of bondage. Chapter 6. The very amiable, pious-hearted Mr. Theophilus Freeman, a partner or consignee of James H. Birch, and keeper of the slave pen in New Orleans, was out among his animals early in the morning. With an occasional kick of the older men and women, and many a sharp crack of the whip about the ears of the younger slaves, it was not long before they were all astir and wide awake. Mr. Theophilus Freeman bustled about in a very industrious manner, getting his property ready for the salesroom, intending, no doubt, to do that day a rousing business. In the first place, we were required to wash thoroughly, and those with beards to shave. We were then furnished with a new suit each, cheap but clean. The men had hat, coat, shirt, pants, and shoes. The women frocks of calico and handkerchiefs to bind about their heads. We were now conducted into a large room in the front part of the building to which the yard was attached in order to be properly trained before the admission of customers. The men were arranged on one side of the room, the women on the other. The tallest was placed at the head of the row, then the next tallest, and so on in the order of their respective heights. Emily was at the foot of the line of women. Freeman charged us to remember our places, exhorted us to appear smart and lively, sometimes threatening and again holding out various inducements. During the day, he exercised us in the art of looking smart and of moving places with exact precision. After being fed in the afternoon, we were again paraded and made to dance. Bob, a colored boy who had some time belonged to Freeman, played on the violin. Standing near him, I made bold to inquire if he could play the Virginia Reel. He answered he could not and asked me if I could play. Replying in the affirmative, he handed me the violin. I struck up a tune and finished it. Freeman ordered me to continue playing and seemed well pleased, telling Bob that I far excelled him, a remark that seemed to grieve my musical companion very much. Next day, many customers called to examine Freeman's new lot. The latter gentleman was very loquacious, dwelling at much length upon our several good points and qualities. He would make us hold up our heads, walk briskly back and forth, while customers would feel of our hands and arms and bodies, turn us about, ask us what we could do, make us open our mouths and show our teeth, precisely as a jockey examines a horse which he is about to barter for or purchase. Sometimes a man or woman was taken back to the small house in the yard, stripped and inspected more minutely. Scars upon a slave's back were considered evidence of a rebellious or unruly spirit and hurt his sale. One old gentleman who said he wanted a coachman appeared to take a fancy to me. From his conversation with Birch, I learned he was a resident in the city. I very much desired that he would buy me, because I conceived it would not be difficult to make my escape from New Orleans on some northern vessel. Freeman asked him $1,500 for me. The old gentleman insisted it was too much, as times were very hard. Freeman, however, declared that I was sound and healthy, of good constitution and intelligent. He made it a point to enlarge upon my musical attainments. The old gentleman argued quite adroitly that there was nothing extraordinary about the nigger, and finally, to my regret, went out saying he would call again. During the day, however, a number of sales were made. David and Caroline were purchased together by a Natchez planter. They left us grinning broadly, and in the most happy state of mind caused by the fact of their not being separated. Lethe was sold to a planter of Baton Rouge, her eyes flashing with anger as she was led away. The same man also purchased Randall. The little fellow was made to jump and run across the floor and perform many other feats, exhibiting his activity and condition. All the time the trade was going on, Eliza was crying aloud and wringing her hands. She besought the men not to buy him unless he also bought herself and Emily. She promised in that case to be the most faithful slave that ever lived. The man answered that he could not afford it, and then Eliza burst into a paroxysm of grief, weeping plaintively. Freeman turned round to her savagely with his whip in his uplifted hand, ordering her to stop her noise or he would flog her. He would not have such work, such sniffling, and unless she ceased that minute, he would take her to the yard and give her 100 lashes. Yes, he would take the nonsense out of her pretty quick. If he didn't, might he be damned. Eliza shrunk before him and tried to wipe away her tears, but it was all in vain. She wanted to be with her children, she said, the little time she had to live. All the frowns and threats of Freeman could not wholly silence the afflicted mother. She kept on begging and beseeching them, most piteously, not to separate the three. Over and over again she told them how she loved her boy. A great many times she repeated her former promises, how very faithful and obedient she would be, how hard she would labor day and night, to the last moment of her life, if he would only buy them all together. But it was of no avail. The man could not afford it. The bargain was agreed upon, and Randall must go alone. Then Eliza ran to him, embraced him passionately, kissed him again and again, and told him to remember her, all the while her tears falling in the boy's face like rain. Freeman damned her, calling her a blubbering, bawling wench, and ordered her to go to her place and behave herself, and be somebody. He swore he wouldn't stand such stuff but a little longer. He would soon give her something to cry about if she was not mighty careful, and that she might depend on. The planter from Baton Rouge, with his new purchases, was ready to depart. "Don't cry, Mama. I will be a good boy. Don't cry," said Randall, looking back as they passed out of the door. What has become of the lad, God knows. It was a mournful scene indeed. I would have cried myself if I had dared. That night, nearly all who came in on the brig Orleans were taken ill. They complained of violent pain in the head and back. Little Emily, a thing unusual with her, cried constantly. In the morning, a physician was called in, but was unable to determine the nature of our complaint. While examining me and asking questions touching my symptoms, I gave it as my opinion that it was an attack of smallpox. Mentioning the fact of Robert's death as the reason of my belief, it might be so indeed, he thought he would send for the head physician of the hospital. Shortly, the head physician came, a small light-haired man whom they called Dr. Carr. He pronounced it smallpox, whereupon there was much alarm throughout the yard. Soon after Dr. Carr left, Eliza, Emmy, Harry, and myself were put into a hack and driven to the hospital, a large white marble building standing on the outskirts of the city. Harry and I were placed in a room in one of the upper stories. I became very sick. For 3 days I was entirely blind. While lying in this state one day, Bob came in, saying to Dr. Carr that Freeman had sent him over to inquire how we were getting on. "Tell him," said the doctor, "that Platt is very bad, but that if he survives until 9 o'clock, he may recover." I expected to die, though there was little in the prospect before me worth living for. The near approach of death appalled me. I thought I could have been resigned to yield up my life in the bosom of my family, but to expire in the midst of strangers, under such circumstances, was a bitter reflection. There were a great number in the hospital, of both sexes and of all ages. In the rear of the building, coffins were manufactured. When one died, the bell tolled, a signal to the undertaker to come and bear away the body to the potter's field. Many times, each day and night, the tolling bell sent forth its melancholy voice, announcing another death. But my time had not yet come. The crisis having passed, I began to revive, and at the end of 2 weeks and 2 days, returned with Harry to the pen, bearing upon my face the effects of the malady, which to this day continues to disfigure it. Eliza and Emily were also brought back next day in a hack, and again we were paraded in the sales room for the inspection and examination of purchases. I still indulged the hope that the old gentleman in search of a coachman would call again, as he had promised, and purchase me. In that event, I felt an abiding confidence that I would soon regain my liberty. Customer after customer entered, but the old gentleman never made his appearance. At length, one day, while we were in the yard, Freeman came out and ordered us to our places in the great room. A gentleman was waiting for us as we entered, and inasmuch as he will often be mentioned in the progress of this narrative, a description of his personal appearance and my estimation of his character at first sight may not be out of place. He was a man above the ordinary height, somewhat bent and stooping forward. He was a good-looking man, and appeared to have reached about the middle age of life. There was nothing repulsive in his presence, but on the other hand, there was something cheerful and attractive in his face and in his tone of voice. The finer elements were all kindly mingled in his breast, as anyone could see. He moved about among us, asking many questions as to what we could do, and what labor we had been accustomed to. If we thought we would like to live with him, it would be good boys if he would buy us, and other interrogatories of like character. After some further inspection and conversation touching prices, he finally offered Freeman $1,000 for me, $900 for Harry, and $700 for Eliza. Whether the smallpox had depreciated our value, or from what cause Freeman had concluded to fall $500 from the price I was before held at, I cannot say. At any rate, after a little shrewd reflection, he announced his acceptance of the offer. As soon as Eliza heard it, she was in an agony again. By this time she had become haggard and hollow-eyed with sickness and with sorrow. It would be a relief if I could consistently pass over in silence the scene that now ensued. It recalls memories more mournful and affecting than any language can portray. I have seen mothers kissing for the last time the faces of their dead offspring. I have seen them looking down into the grave as the earth fell with a dull sound upon their coffins, hiding them from their eyes forever. But never have I seen such an exhibition of intense, unmeasured, and unbounded grief as when Eliza was parted from her child. She broke from her place in the line of women, and rushing down where Emily was standing, caught her in her arms. The child, sensible of some impending danger, instinctively fastened her hands around her mother's neck and nestled her little head upon her bosom. Freeman sternly ordered her to be quiet, but she did not heed him. He caught her by the arm and pulled her rudely, but she only clung closer to the child. Then, with a volley of great oaths, he struck her such a heartless blow that she staggered backward and was like to fall. Oh, how piteously then did she beseech and beg and pray that they might not be separated. Why could they not be purchased together? Why not let her have one of her dear children? Mercy, mercy, master, she cried, falling on her knees. Please, master, buy Emily. I can never work any. If she is taken from me, I will die. Freeman interfered again, but disregarding him, she still pled most earnestly, telling how Randall had been taken from her, how she would never see him again. Now it was too bad. Oh, God, it was too bad, too cruel to take her away from Emily. Her pride, her only darling that could not live, it was so young, without its mother. Finally, after much more supplication, the purchaser of Eliza stepped forward, evidently affected, and said to Freeman he would buy Emily and ask him what her price was. What is her price? Buy her? Was the responsive interrogatory of Theophilus Freeman. And instantly, answering his own inquiry, he added, I won't sell her. She's not for sale. The man remarked that it would be of no profit to him, but since the mother was so fond of her, rather than see them separated, he'd pay a reasonable price. But to this humane proposal, Freeman was entirely deaf. He would not sell her then on any account whatever. There were heaps and piles of money to be made of her, he said, when she was a few years older. There were men enough in New Orleans who would give $5,000 for such an extra handsome, fancy piece as Emily would be, rather than not get her. No, he would not sell her then. She was a beauty, a picture, a doll, one of the regular bloods, none of your thick-lipped, bullet-headed, cotton-picking niggers. If she was, might he be damned. When Eliza heard Freeman's determination not to part with Emily, she became absolutely frantic. I will not go without her. They shall not take her from me, she fairly shrieked, her shrieks commingling with the loud and angry voice of Freeman, commanding her to be silent. Meantime, Harry and myself had been to the yard and returned with our blankets, were at the front door ready to leave. Our purchaser stood near us, gazing at Eliza with an expression indicative of regret at having bought her at the expense of so much sorrow. We waited some time, when finally Freeman, out of patience, tore Emily from her mother by main force, the two clinging to each other with all their might. "Don't leave me, Mama. Don't leave me," screamed the child, as his mother was pushed harshly forward. "Don't leave me. Come back, Mama," she still cried, stretching forth her little arms imploringly. But she cried in vain. Out of the door and into the street, we were quickly hurried. Still, we could hear her calling to her mother, "Come back! Don't leave me! Come back, Mama!" until her infant voice grew faint, and still more faint, and gradually died away, as distance intervened and finally was wholly lost. Eliza never after saw or heard of Emily or Randall. Day nor night, however, were they ever absent from her memory. In the cotton field, in the cabin, always and everywhere, she was talking of them, often to them, as if they were actually present. Only when absorbed in that illusion or asleep did she ever have a moment's comfort afterwards. She was no common slave, as has been said. To a large share of natural intelligence which she possessed was added a general knowledge and information on most subjects. She had enjoyed opportunities such as are afforded to very few of her oppressed class. She had been lifted up into the regions of a higher life, freedom, freedom for herself and for her offspring, for many years, had been her cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night. In her pilgrimage through the wilderness of bondage, with eyes fixed upon that hope-inspiring beacon, she had at length ascended to the top of Pisgah, and beheld the land of promise. In an unexpected moment she was utterly overwhelmed with disappointment and despair. The glorious vision of liberty faded from her sight as they led her away into captivity. Now she weepeth sore in the night, and tears are on her cheeks. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Chapter 7. On leaving the New Orleans slave pen, Harry and I followed our new master through the streets, while Eliza, crying and turning back, was forced along by Freeman and his minions, until we found ourselves on board the steamboat Rodolph, then lying at the levee. In the course of half an hour we were moving briskly up the Mississippi, bound for some point on Red River. There were quite a number of slaves on board beside ourselves, just purchased in the New Orleans market. I remember a Mr. Kelso, who was said to be a well-known and extensive planter, had in charge a gang of women. Our master's name was William Ford. He resided then in the Great Pine Woods, in the parish of Avoyelles, situated on the right bank of Red River in the heart of Louisiana. He is now a Baptist preacher. Throughout the whole parish of Avoyelles, and especially along both shores of Bayou Bœuf, where he is more intimately known, he is accounted by his fellow citizens as a worthy minister of God. In many northern minds, perhaps, the idea of a man holding his brother man in servitude and the traffic in human flesh may seem altogether incompatible with their conceptions of a moral or religious life. From descriptions of such men as Birch and Freeman and others hereinafter mentioned, they are led to despise and execrate the whole class of slaveholders indiscriminately. But I was sometime his slave, and had an opportunity of learning well his character and disposition, and it is but simple justice to him when I say, in my opinion, there never was a more kind, noble, candid, Christian man than William Ford. The influences and associations that had always surrounded him blinded him to the inherent wrong at the bottom of the system of slavery. He never doubted the moral right of one man holding another in subjection. Looking through the same medium with his fathers before him, he saw things in the same light. Brought up under other circumstances and other influences, his notions would undoubtedly have been different. Nevertheless, he was a model master, walking uprightly according to the light of his understanding, and fortunate was the slave who came to his possession. Were all men such as he, slavery would be deprived of more than half its bitterness. We were 2 days and 3 nights on board the steamboat Rodolph, during which time nothing of particular interest occurred. I was now known as Platt, the name given me by Birch, and by which I was designated through the whole period of my servitude. Eliza was sold by the name of Drady. She was so distinguished in the conveyance to Ford, now on record in the recorder's office in New Orleans. On our passage, I was constantly reflecting on my situation and consulting with myself on the best course to pursue in order to effect my ultimate escape. Sometimes, not only then, but afterwards, I was almost on the point of disclosing fully to Ford the facts of my history. I am inclined now to the opinion it would have resulted in my benefit. This course was often considered, but through fear of its miscarriage, never put into execution until eventually my transfer and his pecuniary embarrassments rendered it evidently unsafe. Afterwards, under other masters, unlike William Ford, I knew well enough the slightest knowledge of my real character would consign me at once to the remoter depths of slavery. I was too costly a chattel to be lost, and was well aware that I would be taken farther on into some by-place over the Texan border, perhaps, and sold. That I would be disposed of as the thief disposes of his stolen horse, if my right to freedom was even whispered. So I resolved to lock the secret closely in my head, never to utter one word or syllable as to who or what I was, trusting in Providence and my own shrewdness for deliverance. At length we left the steamboat and rowed off at a place called Alexandria, several hundred miles from New Orleans. It is a small town on the southern shore of Red River. Having remained there overnight, we entered the morning train of cars and were soon at Bayou La Maurie, a still smaller place, distant 18 miles from Alexandria. At that time, it was the termination of the railroad. Ford's plantation was situated on the Texas Road, 12 miles from La Maurie, in the Great Pine Woods. This distance, it was announced to us, must be traveled on foot, there being public conveyances no farther. Accordingly, we all set out in the company of Ford. It was an excessively hot day. Harry, Eliza, and myself were yet weak, and the bottoms of our feet were very tender from the effects of the smallpox. We proceeded slowly, Ford telling us to take our time and sit down and rest whenever we desired, a privilege that was taken advantage of quite frequently. After leaving La Maurie and crossing two plantations, one belonging to Mr. Carnell and the other to a Mr. Flint, we reached the Pine Woods, a wilderness that stretches to the Sabine River. The whole country about Red River is low and marshy. The Pine Woods, as they are called, is comparatively upland, with frequent small intervals, however, running through them. This upland is covered with numerous trees, the white oak, the chinquapin, resembling chestnut, but principally the yellow pine. They are of great size, running up 60 feet and perfectly straight. The woods are full of cattle, very shy and wild, dashing away in herds with a loud snuff at our approach. Some of them were marked or branded. The rest appeared to be in their wild and untamed state. They are much smaller than northern breeds. The peculiarity about them that most attracted my attention was their horns. They stand out from the sides of the head precisely straight, like two iron spikes. At noon, we reached a cleared piece of ground, containing 3 or 4 acres. Upon it was a small, unpainted wooden house, a corn crib, or, as we would say, a barn and a log kitchen, standing about a rod from the house. It was the summer residence of Mr. Martin. Rich planters, having large establishments on Bayou Bœuf, are accustomed to spend the warmer season in these woods. Here they find clear water and delightful shades. In fact, these retreats are to the planters of that section of the country what Newport and Saratoga are to the wealthy inhabitants of northern cities. We were sent around into the kitchen and supplied with sweet potatoes, cornbread, and bacon, while Master Ford dined with Martin in the house. There were several slaves about the premises. Martin came out and took a look at us, asking Ford the price of each, if we were green hands and so forth, and making inquiries in relation to the slave market generally. After a long rest, we set forth again, following the Texas Road, which had the appearance of being very rarely traveled. For 5 miles we passed through continuous woods without observing a single habitation. At length, just as the sun was sinking in the west, we entered another opening containing some 12 or 15 acres. In this opening stood a house much larger than Mr. Martin's. It was 2 stories high, with a piazza in front. In the rear of it was also a log kitchen, poultry house, corn cribs, and several negro cabins. Near the house was a peach orchard, and gardens of orange and pomegranate trees. The space was entirely surrounded by woods, and covered with a carpet of a rich, rank verdure. It was a quiet, lonely, pleasant place, literally a green spot in the wilderness. It was the residence of my master, William Ford. As we approached, a yellow girl, her name was Rose, was standing on the piazza. Going to the door, she called her mistress, who presently came running out to meet her lord. She kissed him and laughingly demanded if he had bought those niggers. Ford said he had, and told us to go round to Sally's cabin and rest ourselves. Turning the corner of the house, we discovered Sally washing, her 2 baby children near her, rolling on the grass. They jumped up and toddled toward us, looked at us a moment like a brace of rabbits, then ran back to their mother as if afraid of us. Sally conducted us into the cabin, told us to lay down our bundles and be seated, for she was sure that we were tired. Just then John, the cook, a boy some 16 years of age, and blacker than any crow, came running in looked steadily in our faces, then turning around without saying as much as howdy do, ran back to the kitchen laughing loudly, as if our coming was a great joke indeed. Much wearied with our walk as soon as it was dark, Harry and I wrapped our blankets round us and laid down upon the cabin floor. My thoughts, as usual, wandered back to my wife and children. The consciousness of my real situation, the hopelessness of any effort to escape through the white forests of Avoyelles, pressed heavily upon me. Yet my heart was at home in Saratoga. I was awakened early in the morning by the voice of Master Ford calling Rose. She hastened into the house to dress the children. Sally to the field to milk the cows, while John was busy in the kitchen preparing breakfast. In the meantime, Harry and I were strolling about the yard looking at our new quarters. Just after breakfast, a colored man driving 3 yoke of oxen attached to a wagon load of lumber drove into the opening. He was a slave of Ford's named Walton, the husband of Rose. By the way, Rose was a native of Washington and had been brought from thence 5 years before. She had never seen Eliza, but she had heard of Barry, and they knew the same streets and the same people, either personally or by reputation. They became fast friends immediately and talked a great deal together of old times and of friends they had left behind. Ford was at that time a wealthy man. Besides his seat in the Pine Woods, he owned a large lumbering establishment on Indian Creek, 4 miles distant, and also in his wife's right, an extensive plantation and many slaves on Bayou Beth. Walton had come with his load of lumber from the mills on Indian Creek. Ford directed us to return with him, saying he would follow us as soon as possible. Before leaving, Mistress Ford called me into the storeroom and handed me, as it is there termed, a tin bucket of molasses for Harry and myself. Eliza was still wringing her hands and deploring the loss of her children. Ford tried as much as possible to console her, told her she need not work very hard, that she might remain with Rose and assist the madam in the house affairs. Riding with Walton in the wagon, Harry and I became quite well acquainted with him long before reaching Indian Creek. He was a born thrall of Ford's, and spoke kindly and affectionately of him as a child would speak of his own father. In answer to his inquiries from whence I came, I told him from Washington. Of that city he had heard much from his wife Rose, and all the way plied me with many extravagant and absurd questions. On reaching the mills at Indian Creek, we found 2 more of Ford's slaves, Sam and Anthony. Sam also was a Washingtonian, having been brought out in the same gang with Rose. He had worked on a farm near Georgetown. Anthony was a blacksmith from Kentucky, who had been in his present master's service about 10 years. Sam knew Birch, and when informed that he was the traitor who had sent me on from Washington, it was remarkable how well we agreed upon the subject of his superlative rascality. He had forwarded Sam also. On Ford's arrival at the mills, we were employed in piling lumber and chopping logs, which occupation we continued during the remainder of the summer. We usually spent our Sabbaths at the opening, on which days our master would gather all his slaves about him and read and expound the scriptures. He sought to inculcate in our minds feelings of kindness toward each other, of dependence upon God, setting forth the rewards promised unto those who lead an upright and prayerful life. Seated in the doorway of his house, surrounded by his manservants and his maidservants, who looked earnestly into the good man's face, he spoke of the loving kindness of the Creator and of the life that is to come. Often did the voice of prayer ascend from his lips to heaven, the only sound that broke the solitude of the place. In the course of the summer, Sam became deeply convicted, his mind dwelling intensely on the subject of religion. His mistress gave him a Bible, which he carried with him to his work. Whatever leisure time was allowed him, he spent in perusing it, though it was only with great difficulty that he could master any part of it. I often read to him, a favor which he well repaid me by many expressions of gratitude. Sam's piety was frequently observed by white men who came to the mill, and the remark it most generally provoked was that a man like Ford, who allowed his slaves to have Bibles, was not fit to own a nigger. He, however, lost nothing by his kindness. It is a fact I have more than once observed that those who treated their slayers most leniently were rewarded by the greatest amount of labor. I know it from my own experience. It was a source of pleasure to surprise Master Ford with a greater day's work than was required. While under subsequent masters, there was no prompter to extra effort but the overseer's lash. It was the desire of Ford's approving voice that suggested to me an idea that resulted to his profit. The lumber we were manufacturing was contracted to be delivered at Lemurie. It had hitherto been transported by land. It was an important item of expense. Indian Creek, upon which the mills were situated, was a narrow but deep stream emptying into Bayou Bœuf. In some places, it was not more than 12 feet wide, and much obstructed with trunks of trees. Bayou Bœuf was connected with Bayou Lemurie. I ascertained the distance from the mills to the point on the latter bayou, where a lumber was to be delivered, was but a few miles less by land than by water. Provided the creek could be made navigable for rafts, it occurred to me that the expense of transportation would be materially diminished. Adam Tatum, a little white man who had been a soldier in Florida and had strolled into that distant region, was foreman and superintendent of the mills. He scattered the idea, but Ford, when I laid it before him, received it favorably and permitted me to try the experiment. Having removed the obstructions, I made up a narrow raft, consisting of 12 cribs. At this business, I think I was quite skillful, not having forgotten my experience years before on the Champlain Canal. I labored hard, being extremely anxious to succeed, both from a desire to please my master and to show Adam Tatum that my scheme was not such a visionary one as he incessantly pronounced it. One hand could manage 3 cribs. I took charge of the forward 3 and commenced poling down the creek. In due time, we entered the first bayou and finally reached our destination in a shorter period of time than I had anticipated. The arrival of the raft at Lemurie created a sensation, while Mr. Ford loaded me with commendations. On all sides I heard Ford's Platt pronounced the smartest nigger in the Pine Woods. In fact, I was the Fulton of Indian Creek. I was not insensible to the praise bestowed upon me and enjoyed, especially my triumph over Tatum, whose half-malicious ridicule had stung my pride. From this time, the entire control of bringing the lumber to Lemurie was placed in my hands until the contract was fulfilled. Indian Creek, in its whole length, flows through a magnificent forest. There dwells on its shores a tribe of Indians, a remnant of the Chickasaws or the Chicopees, if I remember rightly. They live in simple huts 10 or 12 feet square, constructed of pine poles and covered with bark. They subsist principally on the flesh of the deer, the coon, and possum, all of which are plenty in these woods. Sometimes they exchange venison for a little corn and whiskey with the planters on the bayous. Their usual dress is buckskin breeches and calico hunting shirts of fantastic colors, buttoned from belt to chin. They wear brass rings on their wrists and in their ears and noses. The dress of the squaws is very similar. They are fond of dogs and horses, owning many of the latter of a small, tough breed, and are skillful riders. Their bridles, girths, and saddles were made of raw skins of animals, their stirrups of a certain kind of wood. Mounted astride their ponies, men and women, I have seen them dash out into the woods at the utmost of their speed, following narrow, winding paths and dodging trees in a manner that eclipsed the most miraculous feats of civilized equestrianism. Circling away in various directions, the forest echoing and re-echoing with their whoops, they would presently return at the same dashing, headlong speed with which they started. Their village was on Indian Creek, known as Indian Castle, but their range extended to the Sabine River. Occasionally a tribe from Texas would come over on a visit, and then there was indeed a carnival in the Great Pine Woods. Chief of the tribe was Kaskala. Second in rank, John Bautise, his son-in-law, with both of whom, as with many others of the tribe, I became acquainted during my frequent voyages down the creek with rafts. Sam and myself would often visit them when the day's task was done. They were obedient to the chief. The word of Kaskala was their law. They were a rude but harmless people, and enjoyed their wild mode of life. They had little fancy for the open country, the cleared lands on the shores of the bayous, but preferred to hide themselves within the shadows of the forest. They worshipped the Great Spirit, loved whiskey, and were happy. On one occasion I was present at a dance, when a roving herd from Texas had encamped in their village. The entire carcass of a deer was roasting before a large fire, which threw its light a long distance among the trees under which they were assembled. When they had formed in a ring, men and squaws alternately a sort of Indian fiddle set up an indescribable tune. It was a continuous, melancholy kind of wavy sound, with the slightest possible variation. At the first note, if indeed there was more than one note in the whole tune, they circled around, trotting after each other, and giving utterance to a guttural sing-song noise, equally as nondescript as the music of the fiddle. At the end of the third circuit, they would stop suddenly, whoop as if their lungs would crack, then break from the ring, forming in couples, man and squaw, each jumping backwards as far as possible from the other, then forwards. Which graceful feat having been twice or thrice accomplished, they would form in a ring and go trotting around again. The best dancer appeared to be considered the one who could whoop the loudest, jump the farthest, and utter the most excruciating noise. At intervals, one or more would leave the dancing circle, and going to the fire, cut from the roasting carcass a slice of venison. In the hole, shaped like a mortar, cut in the trunk of a fallen tree, they pounded corn with a wooden pestle, and of the meal made cake. Alternately, they danced and ate. Thus were the visitors from Texas entertained by the dusky sons and daughters of the Chicopees. And such is a description, as I saw it, of an Indian ball in the pine woods of Avoyelles. In the autumn, I left the mills and was employed at the opening. One day the mistress was urging Ford to procure a loom in order that Sally might commence weaving cloth for the winter garments of the slaves. He could not imagine where one was to be found. When I suggested that the easiest way to get one would be to make it, informing him at the same time that I was sort of a jack-of-all-trades, and would attempt it with his permission. It was granted very readily, and I was allowed to go to a neighboring planter's to inspect one before commencing the undertaking. At length it was finished and pronounced by Sally to be perfect. She could easily weave